Welcome to Design Oracles. We are here to pontificate, evangelize, and educate you on residential interior design and architecture.
I'm Amity Worrell, interior designer of Amity Worrell and Company.
And I'm Diane Kett, architect of DK Studio.
Today on Design Oracles. We're going to talk about the discipline of
sociology.
And how that relates to architecture and interior spaces.
Yeah, behavior and design. Oh, I get really excited about this topic. That's going to be my next life. I'm going to get a PhD in sociology and study.
We also talked a little bit about some of this when we were doing our season on that book, Pattern Language.
Yeah, so pattern language, there were sociologists involved with that and figuring out all of those different patterns and studying how people behave in spaces, public, private, whether it's a house or a parking lot. Still, again, fantastic book if any of you have picked it up or not
yet. It's fantastic.
It's super fun. So sociology is the study of the development, structure, and functioning of human society. So it's study of social problems. It's the study of why we're walking down the street or not walking down the street. I mean, it's just endless amount of study. I mean, when I was one of my first jobs in Austin, I worked downtown and they did not get me a parking pass. So I took the bus every day, which was fine. I had a bus stop by my house and everything. But what I actually loved doing was watching the behavior and dynamics of who sat on the bench and who sat on this seat and who stood and how everybody interacted with the bus and the bus stop.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Mm-hmm.
I do the same when I go to a restaurant or when I go to someone's home. A party is really fascinating to watch. Where do people stand? Where do people not stand? How do people interact with each other? And, of course, I'm looking at it in terms of furniture arrangement.
Well,
and
that's a big thing in the discipline of sociology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always feel like rearranging on their behalf and putting the drinks table is always in the wrong spot. It needs to be somewhere where as a destination. You've been with me when we've had events, and I set up each station to keep the flow of traffic moving.
Right.
And so to me, because I've studied it just personally, I have strong opinions about it. And I also pay attention and educate myself through watching my clients in their homes and how they interact after the built space has been put in place or how it was before we did the work.
And now this discipline of sociology with the built environment is a little harder to necessarily be as an exact science. Like with the psychology, they're able to kind of look that we talked about how they set up and see which parts of your brain are getting, lighting up and getting excited. This is a little bit harder because you're walking through a space. And so, I mean, I guess maybe they can start to do that and monitor your blood pressure and things like that. But there's been more of a study about interactions and processes and how those get preserved or how they get changed. And, you know, the urban development movement that happened in, I guess it was kind of the 80s, 90s, right? That maybe started in the 70s, starting to study all about, like, why do front porches feel so much better? And why is that so much more engaging in a neighborhood? And, you know, all those big towers they built in the 60s to house people caused massive social problems, especially for women and young children. It was horrible for them to live in. It really demeaned their lives. And, they ended up imploding, some of them, right?
Mm-hmm. There was no connection to the outside. The windows were small.
They're all shoved in these tiny spaces. Mm-hmm. There's no front porches.
There was no escape. Mm-hmm. They couldn't interact. The passages were not wide enough for people to walk comfortably and spend time together.
Mm-hmm. And so while maybe we should have more density, you can't have that type of density. That type of density is like too much for society to handle, right?
You got to find the balance.
All like that. And so you're finding that it's more having connection with nature and having the connection of sitting on a front porch, and then you're more likely to engage with someone walking by, whether it's a wave or not, or maybe you stop and talk.
Mm-hmm. Which makes you feel more connected to your neighbors, potentially makes you understand and like each other better, helps with crime in areas. Helps with your mental health, physical health.
And all those were studied by sociologists to understand how all that worked.
I just personally love. I guess they call them like those connected townhome, garden home type things that mm-hmm. are like units. I think that's an ideal living situation for you, maybe at retirement level, where you're not out in the world as much and you want connection to neighbors because you maybe don't go to work each day. But I always admire, a lot of those were built in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them have been really successful. I see them still standing. I see people keeping them up. I see people replanting them. And it's density of living all kind of stacked a little bit on top of each other, but not too high, maybe mm-hmm. two, maybe three levels. And everyone has some sort of garden or connection to a garden, or even just a little patio area or a planting area.
And a front porch.
A front porch.
Mm-hmm.
Or a gathering area, an interior courtyard. And those tend to be spaces that are successful. And you can tell that by the longevity of people staying there, living in them, keeping them up, how they invest in them. So it's a
right.
really interesting thing to study in your own town.
Mm-hmm. So I think you're talking about the interaction too. And sometimes those spaces have maybe a young couple or a single person with a child, or, you know, sometimes people want a space where they don't have to have that upkeep mm-hmm. of all the garden and stuff. They just want the small garden or the
small
patio.
Or like a young professional who wants a little bit of outdoor time and a place to kind of keep plants and things, but spends a lot of their time out and about too. So it's that balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really comfortable living situation for a lot of different types.
And talking about, you know, the gardens and the urban renewal movement that started happening. So Lady Bird Johnson was actually really ahead of her time. Everyone made fun of her for wanting to have beautiful, you know, the beautification movement that she had with the flowers. Well, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, Julia Sweig, I hope I'm saying her name right. Sorry, Julia, if I'm not, if you're listening. But she went and listened to all the recordings of Lady Bird. So, you know, there's all these recordings of LBJ.
Yes.
She went and listened to all the recordings of Lady Bird Johnson. And she wrote a new biography called Hiding in Plain Sight. And there's also a podcast on it if you want to listen to that too. So what's so fascinating that I learned from reading that was she was such a sociologist and preservationist. And part of that beautification movement was she felt like all those low-income areas, in order to help make them better, was to go plant a tree and plant, make it beautiful, and it made you take ownership, and it made people want to walk outside and be near their, you know, front porch. And it was really interesting because as a kid, we didn't grow up learning about that. We just grew up learning that she wanted to plant flowers along the highways. So it was really interesting. And she went and worked with a landscape architect in California to first start studying all of this because they started this movement in California. And so she then brought it over into D.C.
Oh, my God. I didn't know any of that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book.
Mm-hmm.
And also talk about sociology. And we're going to talk a little bit about furniture configuration.
Yes.
She would work out the whole thing as to who is sitting where for all of their meetings, all of their dinners, lunches, breakfast, all that stuff. She totally orchestrated it all. In fact, apparently, Jackie Kennedy was always like, why is she always carrying around a stenograph? You know, it's that little notepad that flips over at the top. She was constantly making meticulous notes about everyone she met, everyone she
That's
was
so fascinating.
Working with, LBJ was working with. She was, yeah,
That's
totally
incredible.
Behind the scenes. No one really knew. And it's been how long that someone went and listened to all of her tapes and records of everything. So
that's a great book. I
anyway,
love that.
So she was kind of one of our premier sociologists working in the White
mm-hmm,
House.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. I love to pay attention to that when it comes to furniture arranging. You know, I'm famous for complaining about sectionals. You've heard me a million times about how sectionals can close
mm-hmm.
off a room. They're wonderful for TV rooms, for family rooms, for spaces where you want to lounge and, you know, private spaces, but for public spaces and for parties, they're the death of
a
party.
Well, so I think that's the point, is it's for laying on maybe mm-hmm. two people for mm-hmm. a whole sectional, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
then people think, oh, I can fit eight people in here. Well, eight people don't want to all sit right next to each other.
Right, absolutely. So when you have a space and you want people to interact, there's a certain distance you want between the pieces of furniture so people can move, but less than you would think, because people want to be able to hear each other when they sit down. And if the chairs and the furniture are too far apart, people will not be able to hear one another when they sit down, so they won't sit down. So your party, if you're ending up with a party of people that are all standing together in one corner, you have a problem. you need to rearrange your furniture.
And then it's this big thing you can't even walk around.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I can't get over across
the room. It's one or the other, right. And so the other piece of it is people can't relax. They don't stay as long. They don't interact in the same way. It makes them feel anxious, and they'll sort of huddle together at an anchoring point. But if you can arrange your furniture in such a way that there are anchoring points all throughout the space and moments of respite for people to sit down, put their drink down, have a table in the right spot to put the drink down, they'll use the space differently. And I think Martha Stewart is someone that I've read about doing this and teaching that you have to show people how to be in your home when they come. And her advice always at the beginning of an event, a party or a social event or a family event, was to stop everything you're doing in the kitchen or kitchen area when your first guests arrive. Pretend that you are completely leisurely and everything's done and you're not rushing around. Grab a drink, get them a drink, and then sit down where you want them to stay. Put them in the spot you want them in, and then stay long enough for them to get comfortable, and then you can leave them there with someone else potentially, or even with a magazine, or these days obviously just their phone, and then you can separate yourself and go away because you've shown them where you want them. People need to be told and shown how to be in your space when it's not their space. It's a really interesting thing. I've done it for events, and it works wonders. You sort of just guide them where you want them, maybe get them engaged with talking with someone, and they won't follow you to the kitchen and hover and ask how they can help. They'll leave you alone, and you can finish the setup. So that's a good party trick. But also with your own family, I pay attention to sort of when my family has these impromptu, wonderful, like little family gatherings that happen accidentally, and what room does it happen in? Usually for me, it's my front living room, which is slightly more formal and separate from the kitchen and the other living areas, so it feels a little bit more special.
Well, what is your seating arrangement in the living room?
It's very comfortable. I've got a sofa facing out, so you have a view of the front yard, and then two chairs facing directly into the sofa, and then a chair on the side with a footstool, and that's where I sit. So I can see when the kids come out of their bedrooms slightly from around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And if they see me there, I have noticed, because I'm not in that room, there's no television. So I'm not typically doing anything other than maybe I'm on one of my devices or I'm looking out the window. They'll gather there and tell me things they would never have told me if I was in the TV room watching television or in my bedroom reading or working at the dining table. So it creates these furniture arrangements and these spaces and these connections, and the way we arrange furniture for people to sit in creates social situations. And if you pay attention to where people never sit in your home, just your family alone, there may be, I'm an anti counter seating person. Some people love it. I don't find it comfortable, but if you are noticing people are not sitting at the counter stools, perhaps you have too many, or they're the wrong size, or they're too close together, or they're not comfortable in themselves. You know, there's all of these different changes you can make to create beautiful and functional spaces that people will enjoy being in.
So sociology, the discipline of sociology, is about how to make these people
socialize,
interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so furniture configurations really help do that. Now, another thing that's interesting on furniture is looking in airports. And so we used to have these giant rows. Some airports still do, and no one sits next to each other unless they absolutely have to and there's no other seats left, right? Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but lately there's been a trend where they'll have individual seats and a table in between, and it might be a group of four facing each other. And so you can still have four different individuals that don't know each other, or you can have a group of people that do know each other all sitting there. But no one's, like, arm to arm.
It's fascinating,
it
really
is.
I love
and
it.
And that's all a sociological thing that's happening right there.
I love to go to restaurants and pay attention to that too. There are certain tables that nobody wants to sit at. I often ask them to move me from places if it's uncomfortable. A lot of it's about what view are you looking at. And it's funny, you would think it's that you want something really spacious and things far apart, but it's not necessarily true. A lot of the restaurants that I lived in New York for many years, and a lot of the restaurants there have lots and lots of tables all crammed together, but they still feel good. They still feel comfortable, and it's more about the light in the space or the distance between is close enough that people feel like they can be in a public, you know, when people go out, they want to feel like they're in public. There's a reason they're going out. They would stay home if they wanted private. So there's just like a certain balance that you want to achieve to get that social feeling and that connection where you can listen into other people's conversations a little bit, but have your own conversation. And it's just interesting when you look at restaurants and see where people sit and stay and spend more money. And where people pack up and go. And it's just a really fascinating thing to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. So also having kind of socially supportive spaces, like supporting relationships, like you talked about the front living room where your kids would be more likely to come in. I mean, there's kind of, when we talked about pattern language, there's the couples realm, mm-hmm. there's we talked about like the family table inside the kitchen, how there was that could happen, and how that is creating these social things that are happening within a space. So it's about how you place that furniture and create those seating moments mm-hmm. within spaces.
It's also, I think it's interesting to pay attention to what happens if you start moving furniture around to create different pathways through a room. If a room is not getting used, people are just passing through it, and all this lovely furniture that you have isn't getting sat on or used. Sometimes if you pull pieces apart a little bit and create a pathway, force people to walk through the spaces, and then maybe make sure that each spot has a table, as Diane was just mentioning about airports. People really like a table because they can put their bag down, their important things, their device, their phone, even just briefly. Not having that spot is a spot to put something down, keeps people away. So if you make sure that each seating area has that kind of spot, you will find people will begin to sit there. And sometimes, as I say, because patterns get created in families and in groups, to change those patterns, you have to change the arrangement. And then you have to sometimes show people how to use the space. So, like I say, do some examples, like sit down and try to show people, here's where we're going to sit and have this conversation, or set up a game or Lego set or cocktails or whatever it is. I often have, when I have dinner parties, I will, because I'm maybe getting uncomfortable at the dining table, I will ask everyone to leave all their things at the dining table and move to a different space, because maybe I want to keep the conversation going, and I can sense that people are getting uncomfortable in their chairs and they want to continue to socialize, but they're getting stiff, and you know, we're not all young, so we move and they'll stay longer and they'll lounge, and then the moment changes. And so I guess I'm like Diane. I find this endlessly fascinating to see how people behave based on their environment changing.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also kind of the office movement. It's been interesting because before the pandemic, suddenly we were going to, you know, there was the cubes, right? And so people kind of had a defined sense. Well, we had the offices, and then we went to the cubes, and how then there was, what did they, the little animal that pops up out of its hole?
I can't think.
So you would be doing that as you pop up out of your cubicle to look at other people. And and the firms I was at, they kind of had cubicles with like three or four people in them. And that was also starting to be a trend. And then eventually they got rid of all the cubes and no one would talk to each other, they realized. So they'd have these long rows of desks that everyone's sitting at. There's no longer a cube. And this was our big movement in the 2000s, 2010s. And they realized that no one talked to each other anymore. They would send an email, and it might be to the person one or two desks down. Mm-hmm. Instead of getting up, even in the cubes, you'd get up and yell at the person or, you know, walk over to them. So it really is interesting, I mean, just looking at that and how that, what that did to the office environment.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's too much openness. Mm-hmm. It's not enough separation, and it doesn't feel as safe to sort of engage in maybe a little bit of fun banter because you don't want to interrupt other people. You don't know what they're working on. And so it prohibits your self-expression. I could see that for sure. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, architecture firms and interior, they all have gone to that.
Yeah, and interesting.
It's become really silent.
Interesting, yeah. And people have their headphones in and right. listening to podcasts.
Of course they are.
Absolutely.
So that's another, like, furniture, and again, the sociology of the arrangement of furniture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And whereas before people were in offices, so then they felt like they were completely removed, but then it was really private.
Yeah. Yeah, and I at my studio, we have openness in our main room, and then there are offices with one or two people in each with doors that shut. And to me, it feels really good because we can convene in the main room, but we can also go into our own spaces and close the doors. But it's interesting that the most desired office space that I have is the smallest and the messiest. And really, people are arm wrestling to get in there for some reason. I'm not sure why. Nobody wants to give up that spot, even though I feel like it's cramped and small. And I think it has something to do with where it is energy-wise in the space, like in the house itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of anchored in one area that you can sort of feel like you're overseeing everything, but from a distance, and you have a little bit of separation and a little bit of connection. So it's interesting, that kind of balance, and human beings are persnickety, I guess, and, you know, we want a little bit of everything, and we want to be able to retreat and gather.
Well, they're starting now in the offices to have these separate little 10x10 rooms or a 6x6 room or a banquette even that's built in, like poche within the wall, that then mm-hmm. you can go have this meeting with this person. I guess you send them an email and say, meet me at the banquette mm-hmm. in 10 minutes. So they're starting to do that to deal with the other thing, because those open offices take up less square footage, so it's less to lease. Now there's people working from home, the remote working, being in the office sometimes, people sharing desks. So that'll be a whole nother study that will happen
for
in
sure.
another 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's always that 15, 20-year view that then we get to see what we did right
yes.
or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then even, you know, going to architectural modernism and the Bauhaus movement and mm-hmm. the Bauhaus school, I mean, Corbusier was trying to be this great socialist and trying to create these great urban spaces for people to live and convene and have great
utopias.
Social
mm-hmm.
behavior
social utopias. Mm-hmm.
interactions, right? And they didn't always work out so well. And most of them actually didn't work out so well.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when I was in Italy studying, we went and looked at a lot of the fascist architecture that got built during Mussolini and how they stripped stuff down. I remember this one building. I can't remember the town, but there were 13 doors all lined up. It was just a glass and steel facade, kind of a cube,
mm-hmm.
and all the doors would just open automatically all at once, and then they'd come marching out.
Oh, goodness.
So that's really an interesting play in social behavior, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then that was the whole socialist movement. So the architecture and the built environment really does play such an important role in our sociology, how we behave in our spaces.
It just makes me itching to just desperately change all of those things. Whenever I go to people's houses or like I say, a restaurant or an event, and I see some clogged up spot or some very small tweak that could happen that would really change the entire event, it's hard for me not to act, especially if I've had a few drinks, start moving tables around.
Yeah, so, I mean, think about public spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, there's that Paley Park in New York City that we both
Paley
love.
Park, yes.
Just down from the MoMA, if mm-hmm. any of you are in New York.
53rd
just
Street.
Go
mm-hmm.
on down. It's this cool little pocket park. And so what's amazing about that, and we studied that in school, is really cool. So it's got a wall of water, a waterfall at the back. So you've got sound, you've got water, and then it has all the same types of trees. I can't remember what they
mm-hmm.
are.
And also it's got, the waterfall is lit.
Mm-hmm.
up from below, and so when it shines up, it looks like almost very loud. It blocks out all of the city noise. All you can hear when you're sitting there is the water. It's like a respite. Every
mm-hmm.
once in a while, you kind of hear a horn, but mostly it's an escape. It's a pocket, a little pocket to go escape while you're in the middle of the city.
And now that's a tall space. It's not
it's
very
beautiful.
Big.
It's
one
little.
Building
they're
wide
little.
Or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have tables and chairs that only seat four.
Saarinen.
Mm-hmm. So they're just, you know, all perfectly set around this little arcade of trees with the water at the back.
It's and very so that interior just, feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. the sociology of that discipline of that space is pretty amazing.
And I would tell you that probably 75% of the architecture students in this country make that a pilgrimage, that park is a pilgrimage they go to just to sit because it is such an incredibly successful space mm-hmm. that makes people feel really, really good.
Yeah, how come we don't have one in Austin?
I don't know. I love it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I could still keep talking about sociology and discipline of the space and human interaction. And as we know, Amity loves to keep moving the furniture. So we are going
to
let you go.
Thank you for listening.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Design Oracles with Amity Worrell, owner of Amity Worrell & Company, and Diane Kett, owner of DK Studio.